Intro or no intro? I don't know. Of course there's going to be an intro. It's Radio Mysterioso, and as mentioned online, there's no guest this week, but I decided to come in because a lot of stuff happened in the last week, I think. Somebody wants to know how you listen to the radio show. Let me type in, go to the killradio.org site. There you go. I hope you can hear it. So yeah, what I wanted to do was take a break since I put those three shows up last week. That was kind of a marathon. Well, let's explain that here in a minute after this.
Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Jeez, I was having a coughing fit. I don't know what's going on in this studio, but I was coughing like mad. What did I say I was going to mention before this? Oh, yeah, all the stuff that's gone on. The show from last week, the Roswell slideshow, that got downloaded, I think, about 700 times in the first, like, day that it was put up, which is usually, I think most shows get downloaded about 200 times, 250 maybe. Sorry, I have to drink to keep from coughing. That's an old song, right? I gotta drink to keep from coughing. And it killed the server. The company actually wrote me that who's the host? InMotion Hosting actually emailed me and said that the show broke the internet and that they would have to get back to me after they fixed the internet. So that was good. I'm glad people wanted to hear it. It was topical at the time. I guess it might still be topical. If anybody would like to call in, that would be great. The number apparently... Oh, you know what? Let me turn on the Skype so you can call in. The number is still apparently 213-438-9958. Wow, I'm still having the cough. See, the Illuminati or the Men in Black have gotten to me and giving this horrible cough because they don't want me revealing the truth of the secret... the evil shadow government. That's it. Oh, what are people saying on here? What did they say about the... Because we had a new listener, Charles Corata, who didn't know how to listen to the show. I assume, stupidly, that when people are on the Kill Radio group on Facebook, they know how to tune in. So I don't even put the tonight on killradio.org at this time. People tend to know that it's 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific time on killradio.org. And then within a couple of days, if there's a guest or something exciting happens on the show, then I will post it within, you know, a week or two or three. Although last week I posted it within a day because it was topical. And it was the first time any of these people, I think, Lance Moody, Kirk Collins, Paul Kimball, had talked publicly about what they did to decode what was on the so-called Roswell slide. Anyway, I also thank Red Pill Junkie for coming on and telling us what happened during the actual presentation, after he'd already done it on the Paracast like 4 days before. But anyway, it really did help, so thanks very much. Let's have nobody's calling, so let's. If they do call, it'll come right through and it'll make noise on the feed here on the live feed, because I don't have a separate music and phone line. It's all coming through my little computer. Oh, geez, I have to plug the computer in, or it'll run out of money. My computer's going to run out of money if we're not careful. Just to give me some time to do some things and set things up, here's a 4 minute and 50 second song by Adrian Belew, Big Electric Cat, which I've always liked, and some of you may know it. There it is.
water. Yeah. Haunting melody. I must dance. Cecil, old boy, I'm thirsty. Be a nice host to your ghost and fetch me a bottle of this, Seven Down.
Yes, sir, Mr. Spook. Seven Down?
I'd better be there. Cheerio, Cecil, little boy.
He's a scared spook. But the spook's spook. What a nice spook.
Flying saucers in the air. Saucers in the sky. I know they're circling around up there, and here's the reason why. Last night I dreamed I was awake, walking through the hills. I dreamed I climbed the biggest mountain, picking up daffodils. Saucer came sailing straight at me. Oh, I ran as fast as I could run and hid behind the tree. They came down from outer space and landed one by one. They gathered by the leader then, and that's when it begun. Flying saucer jubilee was such a sight to see. The saucers came from everywhere to join this jubilee spree. Flying saucers in the air, not a cloud in sight. Up to the Martian band. Well, the Martian music was so strange. We danced till the break of day. But when my clock struck 6:30, the saucers sailed away. Sunday morn, my dancing shoes were thin. The daffodils up on the floor proved where I had been. That's why I know they're circling there, waiting for my tone. And in my dreams I must obey, let them sail back home.
Hey, if somebody calls in, I'll explain to you to talk to me, I'll explain to you why I'm going to contact Jacques Vallée this week. Just think about that one. Oh, there's a call. Oh, my God. My tease worked. Hello?
Hey, Greg?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Ferusha. How are you?
I'm okay. Thanks for calling in. God, that's
loud. Yeah, I didn't, before this, I really didn't, you know, I listened to the taped version, the saved version.
The podcast version.
iTunes.
Yeah.
And I didn't really realize that it was possible to talk to you live at a humane hour.
Yeah, well, it depends where you live.
Yes.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New York City.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a civilized hour for, it's a civilized hour for me, 11:30.
Yeah, no, it's still a good hour for me. I'm thinking, I guess, of Don Ecker and his late, you know, he's kind of an internet friend too. And I've thought of calling into his program from time to time, but I think of it and then I'm always asleep.
Yeah, probably. What is his show from? Like 10 to midnight, I think? Pacific?
It's all I know. It doesn't come on until after midnight
yeah.
here.
Oh, it's not. Like I think it's 9 to 11, I think. So it'll come on at midnight
yeah.
there. Yeah, I think that's when it's on.
So you want to talk about Jacques Vallée?
No, what I said, it was a tease. We can talk about Jacques Vallée. I would love to. People keep bothering me to interview him because everybody else has at this point. And I always wanted to talk to him, and I've been chicken. I'm too scared to talk to him because I'm such a stupid little fanboy that I can't see what I might want to talk to him about. I can see tons of stuff I want to talk to him about, but everybody else has. So I got Red Pill kicked my butt this last weekend, and he said, are you going to call him ever or what? And so I'm going to bother him this week and see if I get a response. I've got this strange fantasy that it's when I do, he'll say something like, I wondered when you were going to call.
Oh, that would be cool. That would be very cool. I was the same way with Russell Targ.
Ah.
To me, he was like the king. And then I went to Omega Institute. Well, actually, I've had a few classes with him.
Oh.
One previous to Omega Institute, and then I saw 2 years ago he was going to be there to give remote viewing classes. And I said, hey, if I don't do it this year, he may not come back again.
Yeah.
And what do you know, the second day I was there, I was sitting at the big round tables with other people from the remote viewing class, and Russell, and I'm probably Patty's wife, and they come out with a cake. Somebody sent him a cake. Congratulations on your last remote viewing class that you'll be teaching. And I said, bingo.
Yeah.
I was right. But I'm so glad I went because now he's a friend, you know, not an intimate friend, but he knows who I am and we're friends. He even sent me a picture of his cat.
Yeah, you know.
Because we're both cat people.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we are at our house too. All we have is one cat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So
I've got four.
Four? Oh no! Have you turned into a cat lady?
No. I've always been a cat lady, so there was no turning into necessary.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to Russell Targ. I mean, that's somebody I just thought, oh well, he wouldn't do an interview anyway. You know, just like
I can't tell you one way or the other. But I've taken a lot of remote viewing classes. I started out with the Memoirs of a Psychic Spy. The guy's name is going to come to me in a second. Oh, I can't. All of a sudden, my mind went blank. I can't think of who he was. But he was one of the Army remote viewers. Then I studied with Skip Atwater.
Yeah.
And Joe. You know, I'm a member of the Monroe Institute, and I studied down there with Skip and Joe and another fellow. And I said, well, let's go to the source. Let's go to the guy who started it all. And so I decided to study with Russell, and he's wonderful. He's wonderful. And now I'm a member of IRVA.
What's that?
And I'll be going down there and checking that scene out.
What's that?
Which should be lots of fun. International Remote Viewers Association.
Oh, I didn't even know there was such a thing. Where are they headquartered?
I don't remember where they're headquartered, but I know most of their conventions have been in Las Vegas.
Oh,
but this
okay.
year, the convention is down in NOLA, one of my favorite towns.
Oh, yeah.
Orleans,
I would love to go
Louisiana.
Back there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I got my master's degree, and it was a great place. I actually was in Baton Rouge, so I went to LSU. But, Louisiana, New Orleans, it's like another country in
yeah.
a certain sense, you know?
Yeah, it's like another country. The only thing that's the same is the language is sort of the same. Everything else is not like anything else in this country. Or at least that area, because I think if you go to Baton Rouge, it's sort of the same, too, because it's southern Louisiana. But, yeah, New Orleans is its own thing.
And down, if you get down into the you know, lower bayou down there, it's like just like another world. It's a whole other world. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I've driven through there. I went to, Avery Island to go see the Tabasco factory. We just drove there. We rented a car. I said, I got to go to the Tabasco factory. That's the first thing. That's when I had Tabasco. It's when I knew I liked spicy food, you know, when I was like 8 years old or something. So it was Tabasco that did it. So I had to go to the Tabasco factory.
I met a fellow in East Texas when I was on my way down to Mexico, and my car broke down. I was with somebody else, and this guy took us in, gave us his trailer to sleep in, and we went out to eat Mexican food with him, and he told us that he was a Vietnam vet and had his legs blown off, but they grew back, and he proceeded to have a whole bottle of Tabasco sauce with his meal. And it was very surreal. You know, it was really kind of spooky, because we thought, oh my God, is this going to be Deliverance or something? But no. We slept in his trailer, and he helped us to find a place that would fix the old car. And we got back in the car and proceeded to go to Mexico, which was pretty surreal all in itself.
Yes, it is.
You know, a 19-year-old woman just taking off like that. It was like, what did I get myself into?
Well, see, when you're 19, you just go, we're going to go do this thing. You don't really think about what's going to happen or anything like that. You just want to see what's going to happen. So
that's right.
Until the car breaks down.
Yeah.
For most people, it's fine because you're so adaptable when you're young. You're just like, well, whatever. And you just take care of the next thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. It's really true. So are we on now?
Yes, we are on. Can I ask you something?
Oh,
about
my goodness.
Yeah. About the remote viewing classes.
Sure.
A general thing. What do they teach you, and did it work for you? I mean, specific. I have a really good idea because I've interviewed them, read their books, and all that. But to actually be taught by one of these people, what is it like?
Okay, I have to I just have to say a few ground things. You know, the first easiest things. It's that remote viewing is a protocol for clairvoyance. In other words, remote viewing, it's not exactly a separate thing, but it's a protocol that was developed, by people at SRI, that is Russell Targ and, I can't remember the other guy's name.
Hal Puthoff.
The other physicist. Harold Puthoff.
Yeah.
Yes, Harold Puthoff. And they were helped along by Ingo Swann. And then it was taken over by the DIA.
Right.
And they developed it as a protocol to, like, calm the monkey brain, calm the left side of the brain so the right side of the brain could operate.
Right.
And so what you're really doing is being clairvoyant, but you're being clairvoyant with the help of a protocol and other people. It takes three people to do remote viewing successfully, and probably more, you know, as a control group, like other people doing the same thing at the same time. So if you get five people out of seven that are seeing a ship sinking, then you can be pretty sure that it's a ship sinking that is the target. Because it's a for the most part, traditional remote viewing, CRV, you have no idea of the target.
Yeah,
it's different from associated remote viewing.
Yeah.
So what happens is that you have somebody who chooses the target. You have somebody else who is there with you to sort of ask you the right questions. But that person, that second person, doesn't know what the target is. They just know, like, when you get stuck, they know where to guide you. And, you know, there's a particular protocol. And there were two main areas where remote viewing was developed, and that is the one that, you know, I'm most familiar with, that is the SRI one.
Yeah.
But concurrently, the Navy Office of Special Intelligence or something of that nature was concurrently developing a remote viewing program. Now, if you wanted to study that type of remote viewing, you would go out to Hawaii to do it because they're still giving lessons, the guys that did that.
Okay. ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, probably.
Yes, probably. See, I don't know these
acronyms.
Acronyms, right. But that one was even more particular and kind of detailed. Like, you have to have a sheet of paper that's a certain size, your pencils, you have to have two sharpened number two pencils exactly 2 inches away from the paper, and everything has to be lined up with the edge of the desk. So for these guys, they gave the monkey brain something to do. They gave the left brain something to be concerned about, because, you know, they're guys, you're a guy, you understand this.
Yeah.
and they had to have something to do, so that the right brain could be set free to allow them, the remote viewer person, to be psychic, basically.
Yes.
And if you have several people doing it, you're not confined to what one person says. Like, one day I could be on and the next day I could be off, right, as a remote viewer. But if you've got, you know, eight guys in a shack somewhere, all looking at the same target in different cubicles, and like I said, five or six of them come up with something similar, you got something going there.
So
you know
they,
something.
So I would think that these people that are all in the same place at the same time doing it, they're not communicating with each other at the time, are they? They're like you said, they're in separate rooms.
No.
Or whatever, because otherwise they're going to start contaminating each other and pull yourself away.
Exactly.
From the, yeah, okay.
Exactly. And frankly, having not been in one of those think tank positions myself, I don't know if they did it concurrently all at the same time, or they did it sequentially, like maybe two of them with two handlers at a time, and then the next two, and then the next two.
Yeah.
But, you know, just I think the most compelling case of remote viewing involving UFOs used to be on the internet on a blog by Skip Atwater, who, of course, ran the DIA remote viewing program for a number of years.
Yeah.
And he wrote a blog that I haven't seen it recently on the net there, but it contained, he had a target, which some boat lost all its passengers. It was some kind of a military boat, not an American military boat, could have been Argentinian or something down in South America. And the people, the boat was left without people on it, okay? And it was something of a mystery. And he had different remote viewers view the boat, but they didn't know what they were viewing. They had no idea where it was in time, where it was in space, that it was a boat, that it was anything, okay?
Right.
And a group of them, not every single one, because not everybody gets the target, but a group of them saw aliens boarding the boat and taking the people away, that there was a UFO, aliens came, they took the people off the boat, and the boat was gone. And it, and they, the target was this empty boat, but none of the guys knew that.
Right.
And I found that to be, you know, the most compelling case. And I could have details of it wrong. You know, there could be minor details, but that was the gist of the story. And I found that most compelling intersection of remote viewing and UFOs.
Yeah, there's been a few of those. I think I can't recall any right now. But the thing is, somebody, one of the commenters on the site just says the most important thing to improve accuracy is closing the loop, that is showing the viewer the target after the viewing. Is that happen in all remote viewing or just, what is it, associative remote viewing?
Controlled CRV.
Controlled,
you know, whenever possible, when you're studying remote viewing, that's very, very important, because you're supposed to visualize yourself being happy when you see the target.
Right.
You see, and so if you, before you go in, think, oh, I'm going to be so happy when I see the target because I'm going to be successful,
yeah,
and I'm going to see what I like that, then that's it, it is very important to close the loop in that regard. However, many of the military applications for this, the handlers, nobody knew what was really at the target.
Yeah, because
in
they
other words,
they,
if you were trying to view a vault in the Kremlin, let's say, just for argument's sake,
yeah,
they wouldn't have you viewing it if they knew what was inside already, if you were a military remote viewer.
Right. So,
so
you didn't really know. So it'd have to be people that are very good at it that don't always need the loop closed like that.
Well, I guess that when you're training,
yeah,
you get the loop closed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because then afterwards, it's not so much of a problem. But then, actually, he also said that when Ingo Swann said he saw bases and things on the moon going on, as described in his book Penetration, there's no way for him to find that out, really.
That's exactly right. But the difference between the story that I told you and the story that Ingo Swann wrote, and I have the utmost respect for Ingo Swann, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Ingo Swann is one man. He was one man.
Yeah.
And it's like one, and Joe McMonagle saw giant people on Mars.
Right, right. Okay, that's the other one, yeah.
But one person is one person. This case with Skip Atwater, who was the monitor in this case, it was a group of viewers that saw the same thing who were separated from one another. So what's the chances of that? You know what I'm saying? It gives more verisimilitude, or is that the right
word?
I don't know.
I'm not cutting it down or being, you know, overly skeptical about it. If you've listened to this show, I've mentioned a few times that I don't have a lot of, you know, I'm pretty much on board with the remote viewing protocol, with the theory of it. And I've interviewed David Morehouse.
David Morehouse was my first teacher.
Okay. David,
sorry.
Yeah.
I've interviewed
Morehouse, Lynn Buchanan, and Joe McMonagle.
Cool.
All those
people I've spoken to
at length. And I've also used.
I know Joe pretty well.
Okay. I've also used.
Pretty much a friend, yeah.
Oh, that's good. I've pretty much used all the techniques that they've come up with and sort of reported in their books. And the first couple times I use them, because there's the beginner's luck, because you're not trying yet. I got a pretty good hit the first couple times I did it, and then it declined very quickly after that. I mean, they're like unequivocal hits, and I've never done anything like that before. So that pretty much convinced me, at least in a personal way, in addition to all the anecdotal, scientific, and all the other evidence that's come up for it, that there is something to it, and that it works occasionally. I also interviewed Dean Radin, and I said, what's going on? How come some of these people are very good at it and some can't? He goes, well, just think of it in terms of, like, how many Michael Jordans are there? There aren't too many.
Right.
And think of that, you know, some people are psychic, I guess, Michael Jordans. And there's only a few of them. Everybody can do it. Everybody can throw a basketball, but not everybody can sink it every time like Michael Jordan did. So,
Right. That's exactly the case. But I think that it's a little more open-ended than just basketball. I think of it like singing, and that most people can, you know, sing Happy Birthday or Three Blind Mice. There's a few people who can't at all. Then there are some people who sing great opera. There are some people that sing great blues. There are some people that sing great reggae. And so there are different ways to be psychic. It's not so singular as the basketball skill.
Well, this was a very wide thing. It is as much of an art as it is a skill. So it's a lot more like, I think your music analogy is very well taken. Because it's, like you said, there's many shades to it, there's many ways to do it, and there's many ways to show that you're good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, and the funny thing about it is some people don't like some of the ways people are good at it. Just like some people don't like music, you know?
That's the definite truth. Well, I guess my point about the going in here, just to clear things up, not to hit on something, but was not that I think Joe McMonagle is great. I think Ingo Swann was great. But the difference between one person viewing a target that you can never really verify, probably we can't verify it in our lifetime, with like four guys out of six or nine guys out of 12 getting this target and seeing basically alien beings when they didn't know what it was in time or space is a lot different. You know, it's a lot more. And by the way, Joe McMonagle may have been one of those guys who viewed that. I don't know that. I couldn't sign my name in blood on that one, but he may have, you know, because Joe and Skip worked pretty closely together over the course of years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is that there's no way for us to verify that. Even though there's 9 out of 12, that's fairly compelling. I don't know what to say about it because there's no way for us to verify such a thing at all.
No. And there won't be anytime soon, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But it's the cool thing about it is that, maybe not in that case, but when you have 9 out of 12 people finding something that you can check up on, and then you find out that they're basically accurate, there's really no, I can't understand people that just don't, there's like, well, that just can't happen because I don't trust it. It's like, but it's been done thousands and thousands and thousands of times. You think all those people are deluded, fooling themselves and fooling other people? I don't think that's happening in every case. So
no, I mean, there are certainly charlatans out there, but I think it's scientism at work. You know, people who are stuck in the 20th century, a paradigm of a materialist.
Yeah, it's more like 19th century
universe.
Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. I think we're in accord on this.
Okay. Got no argument here.
Not really, but the thing is, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't want to keep, if you have other people that want to talk to you, I don't want to keep you. You know, I don't want to hog the airwaves, so to speak.
No, it's fine. I mean, if somebody calls in, it's fine. If you would like to give way, maybe somebody else will call. I don't mind either way because I'm interested in what you have to say. And you've never called before. It's nice to hear, you know.
No, I haven't ever called before.
Yeah.
So I am a listener. I am definitely a listener. Sometimes it takes me a week or two to get to a show, but I'm a regular listener and a fan. And I'm a fan of all sorts of amusing music about UFOs as well. I've got to find the song about the Calypso song about the guy he's a great lover and he's going to take you on a trip to Venus and Mars. I've heard that once or twice on the show and I love it. I just love that song so much.
I can't remember the name of it, but it's not really a Flying Saucer song. It's more like a Calypso song that has that as part of the theme. I mean, it's not even the title, I don't think. And somebody pegged it, actually, a couple weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or a month ago, and I played it. Were you listening then?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes. Yes, I love that song.
Well, when I can figure out what it is again, maybe do you have the name of it?
No, I don't.
Okay, we'll find it again.
I've looked for it on. You played it. That's the second time I heard you play it, and I had to look back in your shows to find it. So, which I did because I had to hear it again. It was that kind of a thing.
Yeah, there's a. I think if you go back in the comments on the shows. Somebody put a comment up while we were, broadcasting and had the name of it. You have to go down like probably about a month or something just to look at the comments. But somebody, I think, messaged us on the Roddy Mysterioso Facebook site and actually said what the song was.
Okay, because I'm usually, I'm of course, your Facebook friend, and I'm on the Facebook page. But I usually get the actual shows off iTunes. Because it's just easier.
Yeah, of course it's easier. I've tried to make it. I realized a while back, a few years ago, that you have to make it absolutely, dumbfoundingly easy for people to hear what you're doing, or they will not make the effort. I mean, why should they?
Right. No, they will not. I agree with you that you have to be very. People have a hard time with what would seem. To me, even as a computer, certainly not a newbie, but a computer, very basic level understanding. And some people find it really hard to just even turn on the damn computers. I don't know.
So,
I guess it's a generational thing on some level that older people have a harder time and younger people do it a lot better than I do. And it's just not going to change. You just get to the learning curve where you can ascend to what point of the learning curve you can ascend to, and then it's a fast down sweep from there.
Yeah, I know that's what's happening to me too. I mean, I've got to try and keep up, especially in video, which is what I work in. But what's it called? Encoding video files off of tape and then making them to all kinds of different codings that all the different places need. That I'm kind of up on. But past my podcasting, I'm kind of stupid about a lot of internet stuff. The thing is, I will learn the thing that I need to learn to do what I need to do, and then I stop.
I was amazed when I went, I guess it was last summer, to WordCamp New York, WordPress puts on these camps all over the world where you can go for 2 days and you can learn all kinds of stuff. And I went and it was fabulous, but I was so out of it, as far as being up to snuff with the technology.
Yeah.
And I could tell that I was older than a lot of the people there. And yet I go out into other realms and I feel like I'm a genius. Compared to some people, so it's really an odd world that you can be so far in or so far out of the computer world. There's just so much to learn, so much to keep up with.
Yeah, there's a lot of specialization.
I love the idea of podcasting because it's free, and it allows you to pretty much say whatever you want to say. I mean, as far as me talking to you now, you can cut me off in a flash, but you can say pretty much everything you want to say,
Yeah.
And it's wonderful not to have a corporate overlord.
Yeah. I've said before that if somebody wanted to hire me to do a show, I would seriously consider it, but it would have to be basically in the format that I have it now. I would just interview people. That's fine. But if somebody told me I had to be a certain way or ask a certain question or dumb down what I was saying or explain everything to anybody, I'm not going to do that. I just can't because I don't.
Why should you?
Yeah.
I mean, unless they're going to pay you a whole lot of money, but even then, I wouldn't say anything I didn't believe because having been interviewed by people for the mass media and having my words twisted.
Oh, yeah.
After the case. It is really very unnerving and depressing, and I can't even think of the adjectives. It's just so many adjectives for what you feel like when somebody kind of slants what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, that's happened to me. I mean, I worked on a show called The Conspiracy Zone for a while. For two seasons, I was the consultant. So basically, it would bounce ideas off me and say, who should we have on the show and all this. But a couple times, the guests weren't going to show up or somebody was late. So they said, well, we're going to have to interview you about this is. You will be the expert. I said, okay. And we do a rehearsal. We do a run through. And yes, you're using your own words. But the thing is, once I started to equivocate, like I would say something, and I'd say that's not true all the time. That just seems to be the way it is now. And my opinion could change, as should anybody who looks at this kind of stuff. And they would stop me and they'd say, no, we need you to make an unequivocal, you know, statement that doesn't have any doubt in it. And I said, well, I can't do that. I have lots of doubt about a lot of things. And they said, well, you can't do that on the show.
You're not sure they all come from Zeta Reticuli?
Yeah. It was almost that silly sometimes. But yeah, they didn't care what I said as long as I said something that was clear, simple, and unequivocating. I mean, it's like, this is my position. I'm not going to change from it. And whatever you do to try to knock me off this position, I'm not going to listen to you. That's what they wanted that's what they want on TV.
Yeah, they want some strength. I've had my run-ins with TV here and there.
Yeah.
And they do want some very general types. Now, if you're doing acting, you know, you have to fit in a particular mold, or you did when I was doing it. You had to be the ingenue, the brainless ingenue, or you had to be the jealous older woman, or you had to be the secretary wearing glasses, or, you know, you were not an individual. You were a type.
Yeah.
A type.
Yeah. Well, I don't think all of them are like that, but I've been videoed, not filmed, but videotaped for probably 6-8 different TV shows. I never make it on the show.
I think you're very, well-spoken and very interesting to listen to, so it's their loss, I'd have to say.
Yeah, I kind of thought so, too, after a while. At first, I was kind of like, well, I'm going to come out here, and I don't even get on TV. And it's just like, you know what? I don't care. They weren't paying me for it, so who cares? You know, the only things I've gotten into where I stayed in the documentary was a couple times when Paul Kimball interviewed me. And he left me in his documentaries, even with my equivocation and everything, which I thought, you know, that scored points at me right away. It was like within a few months after I'd met him.
You're pretty good pals, aren't you? You're sort of pals, I take it.
Yes, I don't agree with everything he says, but...
We would have no friends if we had to agree with everything.
Yeah, I know. It's like, you know... And the thing is, after this Roswell thing last week, did you listen to the Roswell slides thing from last week?
I did not. I was so disgusted with the whole Roswell slides thing.
I was disgusted with it, too.
I haven't listened to anybody much on Roswell slides.
Well, then you shouldn't. You know what?
Because I will listen to it.
You don't have to. I mean, it'll tell you what you already know.
No, but I will anyway.
Yeah.
I will anyway. Go
ahead.
Go ahead. I was just saying I was so disgusted by the whole bang and the Haim al-Mossad and the whole nine yards. It was not.
Yeah.
It was not a good day for ufology.
Yeah. Well, I hope that ufology is done away with in large part because of this, because then it'll allow new things to grow. But what I was going to say was that I realized that some behind the scenes here, people were saying, you know, why do you agree with these people and why do you, you know, and I could sense and hear, you know, read that people were saying that, you know, if you're on their side, then you're on the wrong side. Think, what do you mean? The thing was, I'm going to get to the point where somebody's going to say, if you agree with so-and-so who I don't agree with, then I'm not your friend anymore. And if somebody says that, I don't care who they are. I won't talk to them anymore. I'm sorry. You can't be like
that.
That's the way a 5-year-old acts.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people in that general field who are very proud, and they think they have the answer and that you better agree with them. I've seen that. I've seen that a lot.
Well, it just doesn't, I mean, that's a totally human thing to do. Everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people do it. I think probably maybe most people have those feelings, and some of them act on them.
Yeah, I'd say so. That's probably true.
And it's not
that's
an excuse.
Probably true of human nature. Yeah.
It's not an excuse. It still makes it wrong. I have many friends. I don't agree with them on everything. Some of them I have very deep disagreements with, but I don't care, and neither do they.
Well, that's good. So that's the way to be, I would say. That's definitely the way to be about friendships, because if you demand that all your friends agree with you, very shortly you're going to have no friends.
That's right.
And sometimes you're better off without some friends.
Yes.
Because they're not real friends.
Yes, well, I...
But that's...
Yeah, we're both old enough to have found that out more than once.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid so. And I really appreciate you having me on. And
thanks
I hope you call Jacques Vallée, because I think he's a fascinating man with very interesting ideas.
Yeah.
In spite of what Christopher O'Brien seems to think that he disagrees with him, which, you know, Christopher O'Brien is a fine fellow, I'm sure, in many ways. But
yeah, well, he's a friend of mine, and I did not know he had I didn't know he had a problem with Vallée.
Well, he did. I may be making a mountain out of a molehill. I mean, he's certainly somebody that I know of, and I appreciate him. But he did make some remark that he thought it has to do with his cameras in the valley there, and how, if the things aren't real things on some level, then maybe there's no, I may be misquoting him. So I'm afraid that, I'll be in trouble here with somebody.
But
he did say something to the fact that he disagreed with Vallée, which he has every right to disagree with part of what Vallée says. I do not disagree with Vallée. I have to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And that I really don't know. I'm an experiencer, and I have had some experiences, but for me to tell you what it was that I experienced, I could tell you what I thought I experienced, but I couldn't tell you the provenance of what I experienced. Like,
right,
it was little green men from Zeta Reticuli. I couldn't tell you that. Plus, which I feel as though, if beings or have the ability to be here with us, if they're not originally here with us, which they might be, I believe that they're able to exert a control on some level. It seems to me that they may be able to exert a control over what you experience.
Yeah, that has been mentioned before. And by many people, actually. And until something like that happens to me, I have no idea, and I remain open.
Yeah, you are not an experiencer, you're saying. You've seen some, I'm trying to remember, you've seen some things in the sky, but you're not an experiencer of one-on-one, any form of one-on-one contact.
Yeah,
Is that correct?
Yeah, I do not believe I've ever had any kind of experience with something that wasn't me affecting me, something that wasn't human affecting me, my consciousness, or my environment. No.
Right. Yeah. Well, a lot of people would say you're better off that way. Because it's, if nothing else, the loss of control is terrifying. There is a kind of terror. And I'm not saying everybody feels this, but at least a number of experiencers feel a kind of terror that is not like seeing a bear. I've been in the woods and I've seen a 400-pound bear.
Well, you know what that is.
Upright.
Yeah.
It's more than that. I mean, and that, that's pretty darn scary.
Yeah.
For me, seeing a copperhead.
Yeah.
In the woods in New Jersey and realizing that it could bite me, and before I got back home, I could end up dead.
Yeah.
That's pretty scary.
Yes.
And it's terrifying, but it's like the only person who's expressed it quite clearly is the a woman. Oh gosh, I'm not going to be able to remember her name either. I'm just senile. She was a MUFON Star investigator, and she lives down south. And she had such an experience where there was something. She went out to investigate a UFO sighting, and then she was out in the field, and there was she. You know, this was her life to do this. Then there was this being standing 10 feet away from her and somebody, a couple of other people. And it affected her so deeply that the fear is just overwhelming. It's not like a normal fear, like, oh, that thing is poisonous, I better stay away.
Yes.
It's like terror in your heart like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah,
that's all I can tell
like
you.
I said, you don't know how to react to it. There is nothing in your background saying this is what that thing is and this is how you react to it. So you're basically cut loose and you're just clawing at, you know, whatever, you know, at nothing actually. We have a comment. Chase Klotsky?
Yes. Yes, okay. That's the lady. That's the lady. Lovely lady. Lovely lady, and that's the person, Chase Klotsky. And she had that experience. And the way she described the fear, she was the person that described it most aptly in my mind to the kind of fear which I felt. But what I would say is no bad thing happened to me. So I had no anal probes, no needles stuck in my belly or up my nose or anything like that. So it could have happened, and I never went for any hypnotherapy or anything of that sort.
Yeah, good
Didn't
for you.
Want to. And but it seems to me that I've not had any bad effects from it. Maybe even good effects, for all I know.
Let me ask you something. Did you have a preconceived idea of how you might react to something like this and what it might be, and how is that different from how you did react to it and how you integrated it? Am I making myself clear?
Yes, you are. I did not have a preconceived notion because I was much too young at the first time it happened to have a preconceived notion.
Uh-huh.
And then as I got older and it happened a few more times, the thing that I found that as I became older, and I think my last experience may have been 3 or 4 years ago that I remember that was very pointed, I would say that I had at that juncture more recently decided to try not to fight it and see what happens rather
right.
than, you know, completely freak out and fight it.
Yeah.
But when it happened, I could not, I was at, you know, there was no way, I wasn't a choice not to fight it.
Right.
So that was what I had decided. I wasn't going to fight it, but I ended up fighting it anyway because it was a reflex, not a choice.
Yeah.
That's what I would say about that.
So it's, see, I've got this idea. And maybe somebody that's had these kind of things happen to them can change my idea or disabuse me of it or something, that a lot of times what we're reacting to is what we think, want, or expect, or we're reacting to what we think we should be reacting to and what we think the thing is, whatever that other is, instead of what it actually is. Is there a disconnect for you with that, or did you, you know, does the thing that you experience
all...
I
understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I understand what you were saying, but when it first happened to me, I had not decided it was aliens, quote-unquote.
Right.
And when it first happened to me, I had no such idea. When it happened to me as a teenager, I had previously, reasonably recently before the experience, had seen a UFO with a group of other people.
Right.
And so I then associated those teenage experiences possibly with the idea of a UFO.
Yeah.
But previous to that, I did not, associate the two.
So when
and,
this...
you know, my book is open on this. Yeah. I mean, I have ideas from time to time, you know, like any person, I come up with thoughts and ideas about stuff.
Right. I was going to see if somebody...
But I am not sold. I'm not a believer type. I'm not much of a joiner, and I'm not much of a believer. I go with my experience. Like, I believe my experience, you know, the old expression, who do I believe, you or my lion eyes? And I tend
yeah.
to believe my lion eyes. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
I believe what I experience is as real to me as, you know, the moons of Mars are real, because it's realer to me because I've never been to the moons of Mars, but I know what I experienced. They tell me the moons of Mars are out there, and I figure they probably are.
Yeah.
But I've never been there. But I've had these experiences.
Yeah. See, it's probably disingenuous of me to ask something from a person that's trying to theorize about it all across this great uncharted and probably... unfathomable gulf of yes, it did happen to me. Because if something had happened to me as it had happened to you, my ideas about it would probably not be as theoretical as they are.
Well, I can tell you that it's absolute, you know, whatever has happened to me for the most part has been absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, in a very deep inner way, in a biological way. It's biological terror as
yeah.
opposed to known fear. Okay?
Yeah.
That I can tell you for sure, as far as I'm concerned. There's no doubt in my mind. And I argued that with people who say, well, you know, you should just do this. And if you would just let go, you would feel better. And it's like, no, that's not a possibility. It's just not biologically possible. That much I can tell you beyond the shadow of a doubt. Other than that, I have to say that I don't think I have had any lasting negative effects, though I do understand that some people have.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the same thing happened to me as happened to them, because I really don't know.
Do you find in talking to other people that there are points of many points of similarity, or do you feel like your experiences are a little bit more individualistic? And do you feel like as a whole that people you've talked to, if you have, that have had these things happen to them, is it individualistic in any way, or are people go through pretty standard?
Oh, gee, that's a big question. I may not have the data bank to respond to it exactly.
That's okay.
But I will say the following, that many people report having seen grays. I have never seen a gray. I have seen, as a child, I used to see little metallic beings. And there's a fellow that's been on your show, he's been on a few shows, who had similar things as a child, like having sort of playmates around that were like sort of metallic, and, you know, they gave them names, gave out their names to me and everything.
Yeah.
And that was very benign as a child. That was a very benign experience.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the experiences were terrifying. And then when I was in my late teens, right to about 30 years old, I had a few visitations from what looked like a Nordic being, a sort of like an angel without wings kind of being, but not necessarily somebody who did nothing bad to me, but I didn't get the feeling that they were like godlike, or that they could only do good or something like that, where you think about angels.
Yeah.
But I didn't know at that time. I had never read the literature about there being different types of people, see different types of aliens, et cetera, et cetera. And then about 5 years after my last experience with such a being, I was in a bookstore on, I guess it was on Lower Broadway, and they had a magazine rack, and there was a magazine about the paranormal, and I picked it up, and I almost fell on my butt. Because they had this article about, you know, people see grays, they see insectoid types, they see reptilian types, and I'm just sort of going to sleep saying this is weird. And then they see these tall, you know, golden alien types, you know, this Nordic type. And I said, oh, my God. And I read it, and I got chills, because that's what I had seen at one point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that was kind of strange. So I guess there are other people who see that. But I never saw a gray. Never saw a gray.
Okay. All. Well, I'm not going to try and deconstruct you anymore.
Okay.
But it's thanks for being patient with my questions.
No, not at all. And thanks for letting me talk to you. And it's been a real pleasure. And I'll call in again sometime if you allow me to speak.
Yes. Well, I would love that.
And have a great night. And I'm really very ashamed. if you met me, you'd never know. Anyhow.
Anyhow, I believe you. What's your name again? Farusha.
Farusha. That's the name that I use. You know,
good.
I
did remember.
I have a different name as a person on Facebook when I write into your show.
All right.
Site on Facebook.
Well.
So great
much.
To speak with you.
Same here.
Have a great night.
All right. You too.
And take care. Bye.
You too. Thanks. Well, Farusha called in. That was very nice. What was that like? That was probably 45 minutes of a very good conversation with one of the listeners. Thanks so much for calling in. Wow, it's noisy up here today. I think I'm going to get up and close the window here when I play some more music. You know what? I'll continue the your cheat and heart in I think it's Vietnamese or Thai. Maybe somebody can tell me on Radio Mysterio. So here, jeez.
มาเลี้ยงควายเฒ่าพอควายกินข้าวนกเอี้ยงหัวโตโอแม่นมุมเอ้ยขยุ่มหลังคาแม่ขโมยกินปลามากัดกระพุ้งก้น What?
Okay, I haven't played this one in a long time, so here we go.
It was the night of the dance in the high school gym, when all at once something flashed and the lights grew dim. Then with a zoom and a zip in the room flew a ship, manned by men who were 2 feet ten, all singing,
"Take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha, take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha."
Each man was made of Band-Aid and a bobby pin, electric bulbs blinking where eyeballs should have been. Strange were their hands, made of red rubber bands, and they said, while their feet clicked a Martian beat, "Hey, Earthling,
take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha, take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha."
They sang, all the gang gathered round and clapped. You should have seen how their green wire elbows flapped. Then with some gum and a coke and a pink puff of smoke, they were gone, but their song lingered on. "Hey, Earthling,
take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha, take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha, take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha, take me to your leader, cha-cha-cha.
Driving in the car the other day, and this song came on, and it's very strange. It's taking some takes some feeling of regret or wistfulness or something like that, and compares it to a giant ghostly black bird. And I thought it was relevant to the maybe what Farouche and I were just talking about a little bit. Crazy Jack Blanchard and his wife or girlfriend, I think Misty Morgan, with Big Black Bird. It's kind of an amazing song. It's a little scary, haunting.
I woke up in the night and saw the moonlight shining through my windows. I sat up and looked around, startled by a sound I thought I'd heard. Through the silver hills, high above the treetops where the wind blows, flies the spirit of my love like the shadow of a big blackbird. There was something in the air, I could feel it as I stood there by the windows. Like the sighing of a lover or the whisper of a long forgotten word. Across the silver waters, down the moonlit canyons where the wind goes, flies the spirit of our love like the shadow of a big black bird. I heard a silent call as I saw a shadow fall across my windows. Burning tears were in my eyes as I recognized the voice my soul had heard. Across the silver years, from beyond the sea of time, where the wind blows, flies the spirit of my love like the shadow of a big black bird. Across the silver years, from beyond the sea of time, where the wind blows, flies the spirit of my love like the shadow of a big black bird. Flies the spirit of my love like the shadow of a big black bird. Flies the spirit of my love like the shadow of a big black bird. Flies the spirit.
Nothing came out, my sweetheart. I'm
Hey, here's a song for the Ferrucia as we were just talking about remote viewing. It's I Predict by Sparks. About the
My
background.
Favorite religion is actually like Shinran Buddhism. I was married in a Shinran Buddhist church 35 years ago. And the great thing about Shinran is it's an offshoot of Amida Buddhism. Amida was the Buddha who refused to enter Nirvana until all sentient beings could enter Nirvana with him. And so he reincarnates for perpetually to bring everybody to supreme enlightenment. And part of the teaching of Amida Buddhism is if you call on Amida Buddha once with true faith, that'll be enough. Even if you screw up this life entirely, in your next life you'll do better. In the life after that you'll do better until eventually you do achieve total detachment and nirvana. All you got to do is say in Japanese, Namu Amida Butsu, in the name of Amida Buddha. If you say it with true faith, you will eventually be saved. And in the 12th century, a monk named Shinran meditated on this until his heart broke. He thought it was just not fair to those people who can't muster a true faith. There are some people who are always asking questions, never satisfied, always asking the next question, always a little bit skeptical. I'm one of them. And we just can't manage true faith. We just can't, we're always wondering. Maybe there's an alternative. Maybe there's another way of looking at it. And Amida, the Buddha of boundless compassion, could he possibly leave us out if he intends to bring all beings to perfect bliss and enlightenment? And Shinran decided that was impossible. So Shinran Buddhism is based on the teaching that if you say Namu Amida Butsu once, whether you have faith or not, it's enough. You'll be saved eventually. I think that is the most merciful, the most commonsensical, the most generous, and the most noble religion ever invented. At least it seems that way to those of us who are incapable of true faith in the traditional sense. And so I have said, Namu Amida Butsu, with some degree of faith and with a great deal of skepticism on numerous occasions. I've never managed total faith, but I like to say it because Shinran says whether I believe it or not, it will work. And so I'd like to leave everybody with those words, Namu Amida Butsu. Say them once, and whether you believe it or not, it will work, and all your problems will be solved. It may take 1,000 incarnations, but eventually you'll get there. And hey, we got lots of time.
if we can't trust the doctors and our prayers are falling flat. And the 14 pills she takes each day won't hold the sickness back. Another room to wait in, another test to see if everything we dreamed about will never come to be, will never come to be. Don't you know it's bad luck to be superstitious, but nothing else is working. Sick of all this worrying about things I can't control. These things I can't control. Carefree, where we tiptoed, now we waltz. Past the black cats and the mirrors we cracked without our fingers crossed. The days are slow and easy, the nights feel so serene. But I blink my eyes and I realize that feeling was a dream. Just a cruel dream. I know that it's bad luck to be superstitious, but nothing else is working, and my heart is really hurting, and I'm sick of all this worrying about things I can't control.
Thank you.
Here's an old favorite, Jeannie's Afraid of the Dark. I always love this song.
Her two little feet would come running into our bedroom almost every night. Her soft little face would be wet from her tears and her little heart pounding with fright. She'd hold out her arms, then she'd climb in beside us. In a small voice, we'd hear her remark, Mommy and Daddy, can I sleep here with you? 'Cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark. One day in the summer, we took some flowers to place on some old family graves. Jeannie said, Mommy, ain't it dark in the ground? Oh, Daddy, I'd be so afraid. Then she looked up at her daddy and me and said something that broke both our hearts. She said, when I die, please don't bury me, 'cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark.
Jeannie was always afraid of the dark, and we never could understand why. 'Cause we looked after Jeannie with the very best of care, because Jeannie was our only child. Perhaps it was death that she was so afraid of, 'cause it took her one dark, stormy night. I think we always knew that we'd never see Jeannie grown, 'cause it seemed she was destined to die. But on Jeannie's grave, we placed an eternal flame that glows and never loses its spark. And on the darkest night, there's always a light, 'cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark.
Our Jeannie's afraid of the dark.
They say I'm mad. He's mad, he's mad.
The man is mad. Monty, yes, fearless leader, bring the ashes from the crematorium. Pour the hot water over it. Aha! Instant Fipo! Boy, is he nuts. They tried to tell me it couldn't be done. They were right. It can't be done. Avoid this man. They got to drop the net over him. Oh, loony! See, I told you it wouldn't hurt there.
Hey, it's Radio Mysterio. So thanks to Farusha for calling in. We got, we're over our time a little bit. The thing is, I came in late. I was watching a documentary called Winnebago Man, which everybody should watch. It's look it up on, what's it called? Netflix. God, I can't think of any words anymore. I did not do back announce for any of the songs I played, so I'll back announce from all the way from the beginning of the show, before Farusha called, in the last, 40 minutes or so. Beginning there, I was trying to get everything ready to go. I played Adrian Belew, did Big Electric Cat, Jupiter Jones, The Spook Spoke, Rod Keith with Martian Jubilee, Pirote or Parote, I'm not sure if that's Vietnamese, Cambodian, I think it's Cambodian actually, with a cover of Your Cheatin' Heart, which has a strange alien cartoonish voice singing at the end, which is which made my jaw drop the first time I heard it. It still does. Jimmy Haskell, We Get Messages, Sam Space and the Cadets, Take Me to Your Leader, Cha Cha Cha. Everybody likes that song. Ginny Wright, My Chihuahua Dog. My wife likes that song a lot. Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan with the strangely experiencer themed song Big Black Bird. Mae Kestel, who obviously was the voice of Betty Boop for many years. The music goes round and round. Sparks, I Predict. Robert Anton Wilson did a little talk on Japanese Shinran Buddhism called Namu Amida Butsu. See, I've just said it now, so now I have a chance to be led into Nirvana. Trinket, Happy Right This Second. Sakura and the Quest with I Love Cowboy, with Chinese yodeling in it, which I love. Superstition by Blanche. Grave in the Desert by Sebastian Peabody, whoever that was. I just like it. It's about a plane crash in the desert, so, why wouldn't I like it? Genie's Afraid of the Dark was Porter Wagner and... I didn't write this one down. Porter Wagner and... Come on, somebody tell me. Dolly Parton. Jeez. And the Zanies with Mad Scientist. Radio Mysterio. So, like I said, we'll be back next week. Here's Orgia of Dead 2. The first song I ever heard by the Messertrupe, so I was just playing just now on the back announce.
Your discretion.
Well?
But first, I desire more entertainment.
Well?
Ah, there is yet time.
When? The moon is almost gone. Well?
I know the laws of the night.
I would have time for my own pleasure. When?
Your own pleasure comes only after mine, when I desire it.
Well?
I am the sole ruler of the dark world.
When?
I state there is still time for yet another.
At the first sight of the morning's rays light. She is to be mine!
Leave her alone, you fiend!
Fiend, is it?
If I could get my hands on you...
Oh, you could do nothing.
Leave her alone, I tell you.
Well?
Ah, she will be yours.
When?
At your discretion. But first, I desire more entertainment.